Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For today, at least, the war in Iraq has bumped the economy off the front pages. General David Petraeus told lawmakers he wants the president to hold off bringing troops home for a while. And Ryan Crocker, the American ambassador in Baghdad, said there is progress to report over who's paying the bill. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by LendingTree, where you can choose up to 4 customized loan offers. 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us today. It is Tuesday, the 8th of April. You can call it a pause, as some have, or call it a period of consolidation and evaluation, as General Petraeus did today. Either way, if the president goes along with the general's recommendations, the U.S. presence in Iraq will stabilize at somewhere near 140,000 troops. The White House is set to send a supplemental budget request up to Congress in the next few weeks, asking for $100 billion to help pay for that. On the topic of reconstruction, Ambassador Crocker was sitting next to the general at the witness table today. He said Iraq is actually beginning to pay for rebuilding itself. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
In 2003, some Pentagon officials predicted Iraq's oil wealth would pay for most of the war's costs. 5 years and $700 billion U.S. dollars later, Ambassador Crocker says the Iraqi government has begun paying some of the bills for cleaning streets and stabilizing communities. Nebraska Democratic Senator Ben Nelson told Crocker he'll try to attach an amendment to future Iraq war budget bills that would change U.S. reconstruction grants to loans.
It just does not seem responsible for us to continue to borrow from our grandchildren in China and other places around the world to be able to finance, in effect, what is their future opportunity.
Democrats say U.S. reconstruction payments are especially unfair since Iraq's government is running a surplus. Amy Myers Jaffe is a research fellow at Rice University and worked on the Iraq study group.
It helps Iraq that the price of oil is $100.
But even with all that oil revenue, Jaffe says Iraq doesn't have enough money for its own reconstruction.
The kind of expenses that the country is going to have to undertake to reconstruct not only the energy industry, but also just all the basic infrastructure in the country, is going to cost a fortune, billions if not trillions. And the oil is not going to pay for all of that.
Iraq is still not producing oil at pre-war levels, and oil infrastructure remains vulnerable to attacks. Jaffe says whether to pull the plug on financing reconstruction is a question of U.S. national security. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve released the minutes of its most recent meeting today. It's a somewhat sanitized peek into the Fed's deliberations of a couple of weeks ago, which makes the words they did use all the more sobering. Apparently, some members of the Federal Open Market Committee said they were worried about, and here I quote, a prolonged and severe economic downturn. Nowhere was the name Alan Greenspan mentioned in those minutes. Don't know if you noticed, but the former Fed chief has embarked on a public relations campaign as criticism of his interest rate cutting spree of earlier this decade has mounted. He's had an op-ed or two the past couple of days. The Wall Street Journal had a nice write-up this morning. Mr. Greenspan said this afternoon on CNBC he's got no regrets about any of his policies.
Clearly, certain of our anticipations of what would happen as a consequence of those policies were off. But there's no way of avoiding that. If we can get forecasts right 60% of the time, we're doing extraordinarily well.
Whether or not the 40% that the Greenspan Fed got wrong caused the credit crunch has yet to be seen. He did say, by the way, that we are now in the throes of a recession. But every day the credit squeeze does get tighter. Students and parents watching the headlines might be worrying about how they'll be paying for college because a nonprofit heavily involved in the student loan market has filed for bankruptcy, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
The Education Resources Institute, TERI for short, is like an insurance company for private student loans. If borrowers can't pay, TERI covers the losses. It also insures pools of student loans that are sold to investors in the form of bonds. Luke Swarthout follows the business for advocacy group U.S. PIRG. He says two forces hit TERI hard. As the economy has slowed, more borrowers are defaulting on their loans, and the subprime and credit turmoil has killed investors' appetites for these loan packages.
There's also just a more general unwillingness to buy securitized assets just because of a general uncertainty about their value.
For borrowers, all this could make it harder and more expensive to get private student loans. Lenders like CIT Group have stopped making student loans altogether. Samir Gokhale is an analyst with investment bank Keefe, Bruyette & Woods. He's hoping the federal government will come to the rescue by lending money to private student lenders until the market bounces back.
If that doesn't happen and there are other disruptions, I think students should, in fact, have some sort of contingency plans in place just in case they don't get the funding that they need to go to the school for the fall semester.
But students and parents shouldn't panic, others say. Only an estimated 8% of undergraduates rely on private lenders. Federal loans are still available. And last week, Senator Ted Kennedy introduced a bill. It would increase the amount students can borrow under the federal program. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wall Street couldn't quite make up its mind today. Up and down, down and up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Morgan Stanley wrote off $9.5 billion worth of subprime mortgages last quarter. That was on the way to piling up more than $3 billion worth of red ink for the 3 months that ended on New Year's Eve. So it's fair to assume management and the board of directors would have been in for a grilling today at the company's annual shareholder meeting. But oh, how wrong you'd have been. Every single member of Morgan's board was reelected with more than 90% of the vote. So if subprimes aren't enough to generate some shareholder outrage, what is? Michelle Leader runs the website footnoted.org. Michelle, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
This Morgan Stanley meeting, remind us why it's important.
You know, it's really the first meeting during the annual meeting season where you have a chance for investors to ask questions of some of the people behind the subprime mess.
Those questions might be what? Where were you guys?
Where were you guys? Why were you asleep at the wheel? Why weren't you warning us beforehand? Why are you still paying out huge chunks of change for what can charitably be called mediocre performance?
And then what are the boards of directors going to say in defense of their own actions or inaction?
Well, it's hard to say. Depending on the meeting, you know, some directors don't even have a chance to speak. Usually it's just the CEO slash chairman who's doing most of the talking. In the past, there's even been board meetings where none of the directors show up.
Let me ask you this, though. I mean, we had this whole Enron thing happen 7 years ago.
Yep.
At which point everybody said, oh, wow, boards of directors have audit committees. Has nobody been paying attention in the past 7 years to making sure audit committees do their jobs?
Well, you know, I think what happened is there was a big, you know, push after Enron for audit committees to start doing their jobs a little bit more, you know, closely and a little bit more actively. And, you know, what you had here is the subprime situation really snuck up on people and caused some very, you know, big problems very quickly. One of the things that's really surprising to me is I went back and looked at most of these investment banks and looked at how they anticipated the subprime crisis. And what was amazing to me is that very few of them used the word subprime in their 2006 filings, their annual reports for 2006. And yet in 2007, it was like subprime this, subprime that. This is the reason we're going down. You know, unbelievable amounts of, you know, reasons why subprime was tied to their problems. And it's amazing to me how there was just no foreshadowing of this. I mean, these people are paid an awful lot of money to get it right.
And still, most of them are going to keep their jobs.
You know, we saw a couple of high-profile people who have lost their jobs. Obviously, Stan O'Neill at Merrill. You know, what's happening at Bear Stearns, a number of those top executives are going to lose their jobs. Angelo Mozillo at Countrywide is stepping down. retiring, whatever phrase you want to use. But yes, most of them are keeping their jobs.
What's your sense of investor outrage, I guess, at CEO compensation packages in light of subprime losses and those very subprime losses themselves?
Well, I think there's a lot of anger out there. The question is what can really anyone do about it? When you hear, you know, how much people like Angelo Mozzillo is making, for example, huge amount of money, and he makes a point of saying, well, he was giving back some severance pay that he would have been due for, you know, leaving the company. You know, these token givebacks, that's what, you know, a lot of investors are sort of questioning. You know, John Mack, for example, at Morgan Stanley, he said that he wasn't taking a bonus this year, but he still made a significant chunk of change last year.
So really, if you're an irate shareholder, you can show up at these meetings, but don't expect too much?
You can show up at the meeting and you can rant and rave, but I wouldn't expect to change the world as a result.
If you ever wanted to know what's in the fine print of those corporate reports, footnoted.org is the place to be. Michelle Leader runs that website. Michelle, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
I don't know how to break this to you, so I'm just going to come right out and say it, all right? You're not worth as much as you think you are. Not in a net worth kind of way. That's none of anybody's business. More in a personal information kind of way. Social Security numbers, credit card accounts, all those things we try so hard to protect. A report today from the internet security firm Symantec says your numbers don't add up to much. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Ah, for the good old days, when there was real money to be made in petty theft. The Symantec report found stolen credit card information sold for as little as 40 cents. How about your full bank account credentials? As low as 10 bucks. Kevin Haley tracks internet fraud for Symantec.
Some credit cards in the U.S. are easy to get. Other European countries, not so easy to get. And that affects the price they're charged, just like a regular economy.
The underground internet economy is getting more sophisticated. Bob Sullivan is author of Your Evil Twin, Behind the Identity Theft Epidemic.
There are now these toolkits. So instead of having to be a programmer yourself, you go to some other broker who sells you a piece of software that might look like a new piece of Microsoft software. And you just install it, drag and drop a few things, and next thing you know, you're renting time on hijacked computers and sending out millions of emails an hour.
So why have prices for stolen information dropped? The Symantec folks say it's supply and demand. Cyber fraud attacks increased fivefold last year. There's so much stolen information out there, it's getting cheaper. Sullivan offers a different explanation.
How valuable is a low-limit MasterCard that's been stolen from a bank now? Banks are getting better at cutting those cards off. So if the odds are you're only going to be able to buy something for $20 or $30 and then the card goes bad on you, you're not going to pay very much for it.
As little as 40 cents, to be exact. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Coming up, work and play in China.
Everybody had more fun with it than I would have expected. If I would have done this at home with the group, we would have had mutiny from the whole organization.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slipped a quarter of 1%, 35 points, to end the day at 12,576. The NASDAQ gave back 0.2%, 16 points, to finish at 2,348. The S&P 500 dropped 0.4%, 6 points, closed at 1,366. Washington Mutual led the S&P's downward spiral. Its stock forfeited 10% after the bank said it plans to cut its quarterly dividend and could post a $1.1 billion loss in the first quarter. Lousy sales chipped away at Advanced Micro Devices' share price by almost 5%. The world's number two maker of microprocessors plans to slash 10% of its workforce. Novella Systems expects its first quarter earnings to fall short of analysts' expectations. Shares in the semiconductor equipment maker short-circuited 8% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. By Lions for Lambs, starring Tom Cruise, Meryl Streep, and Robert Redford, on DVD today. And by Clarkson Potters, the splendid tables, how to eat supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker participate in more hearings on the status of Iraq. They'll go before the House Armed Services Committee in the morning and the Foreign Affairs Committee in the afternoon. And the Olympic torch is scheduled to make its way through San Francisco. Tibet activists were already demonstrating yesterday. Officials may alter the relay route. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. $3.60 a gallon is going to be the magic number this summer, the Department of Energy said today. That's where gas prices should top out, which, if you really think about it, might turn out to be good news, because chances are paying that much will make most of us think twice before we take to the open road, which will mean less traffic, less stress, and probably less pollution, too. In fact, economist Chris Room at the University of North Carolina Greensboro has been studying exactly that phenomenon. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. My pleasure.
You know, you'd think bad economic times would do bad things to your health and to society's general well-being. You're telling me that that's not true?
Well, what I'm telling you is bad economic times are actually good for your health. Now, I'm not saying they're good for society, but they do turn out to be good for your physical health.
How so?
What we find is mortality rates of all kinds fall when the economy weakens. So total mortality, vehicle mortality, deaths from heart attacks, various health conditions like back problems become less prevalent. And then people behave in a healthier manner. That is, they smoke less, they drink less, they're less likely to be obese.
Now, is that generally just less stress because you don't have to deal with all the craziness at work?
That may be part of what's going on. There's also environmental risks like reductions in pollution levels, and people have more time, so they might have more time to exercise. Part of it could be an income story, too. You know, if you don't have as much money, you don't go out to eat as much. When you go out to eat, you tend to eat fatty meals. Maybe you drink and smoke. So it could be a combination of factors.
What about everyday things like traffic loads? I mean, if it takes me 15 minutes to get in because people have been laid off, generally a good thing, right?
That's right. And people drive less. Driving's a risky activity.
Do you have any data on mental health as opposed to physical issues?
A little bit. Mental health is harder to measure, and the evidence is much less clear. And in fact, it's quite possible that in bad times, people's mental health actually worsens. So, for example, we find that suicides increase when times are bad.
Probably ought to take a step back here and make sure everybody understands we're not talking about individual episodes here of good or bad health. It's more on a macro scale.
That's right. This is looking at population-wide averages. Essentially, what I was doing was using each state as an experiment. So I was comparing what was happening in one state, so say in Massachusetts or Texas, relative to what was going on in other states. So if the Texas economy was weakening at a time when other states' economies were strengthening, how were, say, mortality rates in Texas changing relative to other states? And the result was very robust, the result that health got better in bad economic times.
It's kind of counterintuitive, though.
You know, it is to most people, and certainly it was not what I initially expected. But there are a number of plausible mechanisms. I might also add there was research over half a century ago where people looked at mortality rates and found results that were consistent with this. And actually couldn't figure out what was going on, and after a number of years just sort of ignored their own results. But actually, there's been evidence on this for a long time.
Chris Room is professor of economics at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Professor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've been telling you the past couple of weeks about rising food prices and how they've led to riots and strikes from Egypt all the way to Vietnam. Today, it was Haiti, where thousands stormed the presidential palace to protest the soaring cost of living. Record commodity prices, mostly wheat and rice, are to blame. And while food is certainly abundant here, grocery bills are heading up at the fastest rate in almost 20 years. That's posing a problem for supermarkets and their razor-thin profit margins. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
I'm doing my weekly grocery shopping at Ralph's, a mid-priced supermarket in L.A. I recently switched from a pricier store, and so have lots of people, says Harry Balzer with Consumer Research Group, NPD.
Consumers will never let food costs rise faster than their incomes. They haven't for 60 years.
Americans spend about 10% of what they earn on food. If food prices go up and incomes don't, most of us will change what we buy or where we buy it. Balzer says that has supermarkets panicking.
The one single advice I give them is you have to look for creative ways to make sure that you give consumers options to keep their food costs moderate.
Like smaller packages, so stores can charge more for food, but customers don't feel like they're spending more. Balzer says we'll see things like half loaves of bread and more 100-calorie packs. Ralph's was selling half cans of soda, but a six-pack was only 20 cents cheaper than the regular size.
You're getting less for your money. Those are cute, though.
Supermarkets' profit margins are only about 1%, so when food costs go up, stores pretty much have to raise prices. But to keep customers, they create the illusion of good deals. Morningstar analyst Mitchell Corwin.
They do lure consumers in with low prices on products that a lot of consumers purchase frequently and hope that they will also purchase products where these supermarkets will make higher margins.
Corwin says supermarkets are also beefing up prepared food sections. Pricey pasta salads and rotisserie chickens might seem like an expensive choice in tight times, but Corwin says shoppers buy them instead of going to restaurants.
People are also trading down from perhaps a major brand to the store brand.
That's Phil Lempert with SupermarketGuru.com. He says stores are expanding their low-priced house brands because they make more money on them.
And when it comes to different products like meat, they're going for a cheaper cut.
Ralph's had a wide variety of inexpensive beef and pork cuts, maybe to make up for the $7 chicken and $7 milk. Yeah, $7 milk. Morningstar's Corwin says prices like that have supermarkets staging more sales. He says they have to offer cut price promotions because store-wide, they can't compete with Walmart.
They can't do everyday low pricing because that exposes the price gap between these stores and Walmart.
And what a gap it is. Milk and chicken cost about half of what they do at Ralph's. But the Walmart was a long drive, and gas is practically $4 a gallon. Plus, when I got to Walmart, there weren't any carts, and the lines were huge. One shopper told me, despite rising prices, she's sticking with her high-end supermarket.
I am a working mom, and I go there because I don't have to wait in line, because I know everybody there, so I haven't changed it.
Supermarket guru Lempert says grocery stores are trying to cash in on this sentiment by sprucing up stores and creating relationships with shoppers through things like loyalty programs.
Do you have a today?
That loyalty could pay off. Americans usually divide their food budgets evenly between restaurants and stores, but as money gets tight, they'll probably eat out less and spend more at the supermarket. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Traveling on business is taxing enough without bureaucracy getting in the way. Sorry to tell you then that foreigners headed to China might be in for some extra paperwork. There are reports today Beijing may stop issuing multiple entry visas until the Olympics are done. Not really a big deal if you're planning a one-time trip to see the games. Kind of a problem, though, for professional expats who go back and forth a lot. American businessmen living in China full-time usually have some adapting to do when they first get there. One of the most curious is the thin line between the personal and the professional. From Shanghai, Bill Marcus reports.
You might think it would be safe to run the China arm of a Wisconsin packaging manufacturer, but don't tell that to Mark Flem. Last year, he took all his Chinese employees, about a dozen salespeople and engineers from their Shanghai warehouse, to play paintball.
Someone shot me in the face and it was bleeding. The safety protection equipment that they provide you is minimal at best.
Flem is general manager of Orbis. They make protective packaging for transporting car parts. Every month, staff and management have an activity, be it badminton, bowling, or dinner. Last summer, they camped on a beach. Sun Fei, who goes by the nickname Bobo, works as an engineer in Orbis. I asked him about the trip.
That have a lot of stories, you know.
They got chased off one beach, didn't eat dinner till late, and fished off a 60-year-old boat. Mark Flem.
Everybody had more fun with it than I would have expected. If I would have done this at home with the group, we would have had mutiny from the whole organization.
Orbis is one of many Western companies in China that have adopted China's collectivist office culture. Western bosses say they like the team-building aspect of these outings. Corporate trainer Gary Wang has worked with Sony and DuPont. He says Chinese companies have to stress collectivism to counter negative cultural trends.
Chinese people as a whole are not very good at working with each other.
Chinese under 30 are more likely than not to be an only child, so many workers don't grow up dealing with conflict.
We don't have win-wins. The win-win is a term like coffee or chocolates is from the West.
One way Orbis's staff and their American manager counter this trend is to eat lunch together every day. Recently, I invited myself to join them. A dozen of us squeezed into a van. 15 minutes later, we were at a relatively nice Chinese restaurant. They come to this place 3 or 4 times a week. We sit down at a huge banquet table. In the middle is a big glass Lazy Susan. There's pork in a clay pot, curry chicken, a fish head, and about a dozen other dishes. Bill per person, $3. Orbis picks up the tab. It's in the contract.
We're a family.
That's Ling Chen. She's an engineer in her 20s and single. This is her first job out of college.
Both are our fathers, and we are our kids. Sons and daughters, no mother here.
And that's the general spirit. In the Chinese office, it's considered rude not to talk about your personal life. Expert Gary Wang says Chinese think the way Americans deal with each other in the office is a little cold.
For the American companies, your co-workers are not friends. You are business partners.
So at Orbis and other Western firms in China, the result is a team that eats, plays, vacations, but most of all, works together. In Shanghai, I'm Bill Marcus for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org/value. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of moral dilemmas. Would you rather have your kids watch The Simpsons or Baywatch? Animated kids with attitude or bikini-clad babes? In Venezuela, anyway, the babes have won out. The television channel there replaced The Simpsons with Baywatch Hawaii in the 11 a.m. time slot. A government agency apparently said viewers complained that the cartoon was inappropriate for kids. That's what the station's general manager told the paper down there anyway. It's kind of too bad for him. The paper says The Simpsons was a rating bonanza for him. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow off 35 points, 0.25%. The NASDAQ down 16 points, 0.67%. The S&P 500 rolled down 6 points. That's 0.4%. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, obituaries as the next moneymaker.
It's a well-read section. You know, they sometimes call it the Irish sports pages, or somebody said it's the way I keep score.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.